Hello, and welcome to Media Industry Conversations. I'm your host, Hannah Wold. This program is part of an ongoing speaker series at the University of Texas at Austin. It's co-sponsored by the Department of Radio, Television, Film, and the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries. This series allows students to meet and hear from industry professionals who share their experiences, knowledge, and thoughts on the rapidly changing media landscape. Thanks to RTF, CME, and our guest speakers, this podcast can now make those interviews widely accessible. This week's MIC podcast features a panel on entertainment law with attorneys PJ Shapiro and Greg Slewitt. Both Slewitt and Shapiro are founding partners at Johnson, Shapiro, Slewitt, and Cole LLP, which was established in 2021 with philanthropy, civic engagement, and inclusion as its core tenets. JSSK LLP represents some of Hollywood's most in-demand talent, including Donald Glover, Florence Pugh, Emma Stone, and Adam McKay. PJ earned his bachelor's degree in social sciences from UCLA, and Greg graduated from our very own radio, television, film department here at UT. PJ and Greg spoke to UT students on November 13, 2023, and the conversation was hosted by Dr. Elisa Perrin. They discussed their career trajectories, the scope of their work as entertainment lawyers, and their views on the current state of the media industries.
All right, everyone, let's go ahead and get started. So welcome to our next installment. We have a panel today, an entertainment lawyer super team. PJ Shapiro and Greg Slewitt from JSSK, welcome.
Hello.
Well, I think we have a lot that we can talk about today. And so I'm just going to first start us off by having each of you in broad strokes walk through what your respective roles are at JSSK.
Hi, I'm Greg Slewitt. I'm one of the founding partners of JSSK. I'm also one of the managing partners of the firm. Basically what that means, well, as a founding partner, PJ and two of our other partners and myself, we started the firm together about 2 years ago. We worked together in the past at a different law firm, and we felt like we had an opportunity to do something really unique. We started the firm together, and we've been persevering through strikes, through the ends of pandemics, and in kind of the craziest time. And it's been really interesting to see how the business has evolved during that time. As a managing partner, fundamentally, we're responsible for making sure the firm is operating at its fullest potential, dealing with personnel issues, making kind of administrative decisions, and just overseeing the success of the firm from the inside. And PJ and our other partner, Matt, had been managing partners at our previous law firm for many years. And I think they were very happy to hand the torch over. So that's my job right now.
Thanks.
Hey, everybody. I'm PJ. Like Greg said, a couple of years ago, we got together and decided to form a new law firm. We call ourselves the Avengers of Entertainment Law Firms because the four of us were sort of at competing firms, at similar firms, but sort of leaders in our generation. And we decided to get together and build a new firm with a very specific intention. My day-to-day is running my practice and mentoring, younger lawyers and helping them create opportunities as we represent clients. Our business is transactional, which means we never go to court, at least not with respect to our work. And we represent talent, artists and creators. So writers, actors, filmmakers, producers, influencers in film and television and related media.
Great, thanks. Well, I'm wondering if you can each walk us through what your initial career goals were from your undergrad days and where either the study of media or the working in law might have fit into either of those.
I wanted to be the Incredible Hulk when I was a kid. I still do. So my early career goals were shaped by my father. My father moved here from another country. He was an aerospace engineer, and in his mind, the ultimate independence was becoming a doctor. So my first gift as a kid was a stethoscope, and I had no choice in the matter. So I went to UCLA for undergrad. I was a pre-med major. I took the MCATs. I applied to medical school, and I had what I would call an early life crisis, where I decided that, you know, I didn't want to go to medical school because I hated the sight of blood. And I thought chemistry was like the most boring class I had ever taken. So I also didn't want to upset my parents, who were dead set on their kid being a doctor. So I decided I would go to dental school. So I took the DAT, which is the dental school entrance exam. And I enrolled in dental school at UCLA. And 3 days in, I realized that not only did I hate the sight of blood, but I have very limited manual dexterity. So being a dentist would be really hard for me. So I dropped out of dental school. And then I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I promoted nightclubs and managed a boxing gym and decided I was going to go back to law school to put off having to decide what I wanted to do. So in law school, I learned that I could get my MBA while I was in law school. So I got my MBA and I became sort of a lord of standardized testing. I was going to take a job in investment banking, and because I had no connection to the entertainment business, I, you know, didn't know much about it. But I then started dating a woman who later became my wife, and her sister was a very young talent agent, and her dad was what I would call a B movie producer. And they said, why don't you get into entertainment? So I decided, okay, that's how the wind blew. And there was a big law firm that was hiring, used to hire one or two kids out of school into their entertainment group. And I was lucky enough to get one of those jobs. And then I was in the workforce. And then I started paying attention to kind of what it meant to be an entertainment lawyer. And I remember being at this law firm, which was a big law firm and great people. But I remember looking at up at the senior partners and sort of realizing I didn't want to be them when I grew up, because they looked really depressed and they were all working like hundreds of hours a week and just, you know, didn't seem like they were living right. And then I studied a bunch about what the what kind of jobs in entertainment law existed. And I found this firm that represented big movie stars and also did big transactions, big, you know, acquisition transactions in Hollywood. And I said, oh, that's kind of right up my alley. I got a job there. And I worked there for about 20 years, recruited Greg to come work with me over there. And, you know, we hatched the idea of starting our own firm a few years ago. And that's how I got here.
Thank you.
That's all going to be on the test. You should know that in advance. I had a very different route to the to where I am today. So I grew up in Florida, as far away from the entertainment business as it gets. And I was really interested in music. I loved movies. I loved television. I studied music. I didn't really know what I was going to do at all with any of that, but I just knew I was really excited by it. And I went and visited a bunch of colleges, one of which was here, fell in love with the University of Texas, and Austin in particular. Felt like that was a place for someone who had my interests. It was a town that really could support that. So I came here for college, was an RTF major, and it was really through that that it kind of gave me a little bit of a path toward what I ultimately wanted to do. Took a bunch of classes. I was a production major, so I don't know if that's still an option here, but I was a production major. But I had Richard Lewis was one of my professors. He was teaching effectively what was, I think, the roots of this course, which was the only class at the time that really talked about the business of the entertainment industry. And, you know, you could be here at that time, this is in the 90s, and take incredible classes about critical theory and film studies and production and things that were really practical or theoretical, but there was very little about the business. And Richard's class kind of, you know, started my interest in that just by putting it out there. So I wound up having internships in LA each summer and trying to figure out like where I felt like I would fit in the business. And, you know, I came to the conclusion that I really didn't see myself as a creative person as much as a business person. And so I was given some really good advice during one of my internships, which was from the in-house lawyer at Michael Douglas's production company. I don't know if anyone in here knows who that is, but nevertheless, he was a movie star when we were younger. And he said, if you like school and if you have good grades and you want to be in the business, go to law school and try to find your way into entertainment law. And you know, if you find it, great, and if you don't, there are other things you can do, like working at an agency or doing other things where your experience and your background will be an asset. So took that advice, went to law school solely with the intention of doing entertainment law. I went to law school in New York, wound up taking a job in LA because I realized, really LA is kind of the best place to start. I didn't necessarily know I wanted to live in LA, but I really wanted to start at the kind of the big show, so to speak. And so did that. And that was 20 years ago. And, the rest of the story as it pertains to starting a law firm together with PJ. But I had to really chase what is a really small target in getting a job as an entertainment lawyer, because you could want to do that, but it really is a very challenging path because there just aren't that many jobs and they're all in high demand. So it took a little while, but then it all worked out. And it really did start like in a classroom like this when I was in college. So it's pretty fun to be back here and seeing all your faces out here.
Yeah, it's always nice when we have RTF's alums in particular, or friends of the university as well. I'm curious, how did you all go about building up a client list, or what was sort of the step? What were the steps by which you were able to sort of gain autonomy and authority with it as the firm?
So again, coming from a background where I felt a real connection to creative people that were doing things that I thought were really interesting and having a bit of an opinion, I really just sought out folks who I thought were special at early stages in their career. And, was fortunate enough to be in a situation in a few different instances where I was able to facilitate a meeting with somebody, whether it be through an agent or a manager, or just, being at an event where this person was, and learning over time really how to speak to people and explain, why, what I bring to a relationship is unique. And I felt, very confident that the people that I was, courting were really talented and had big futures. And I was right a bunch of times. And once you get a reputation for representing people who are doing really interesting things, and once you get the reputation for doing cutting edge deals for them, really using your skills to further their careers in ways that aren't necessarily obvious, then, it's kind of like things spiral from there in a good way. You just wake up one day and you've built a business, and it's not nearly as easy as that. But in retrospect, it's that great fortune of right place, right time, making smart decisions, and being an incredibly good student of the practice, so that when you have that shot, when you're given that opportunity with a particular client, you're able to execute, and that just creates a reputation, and then from there it becomes a whole lot easier.
So I'm, a big believer in hard work creates luck, and building a practice for me was a combination of hard work and luck. You have to get a couple of good bounces. I got a job at this firm out of school and then moved to my prior firm, which is called Ziffer & Brittenham. And it's been around about 45 years and one of the preeminent talent firms. And I got over there, in my late 20s. And right away, I was sort of the baby lawyer on big, big accounts representing people like Bruce Willis and Eddie Murphy and Harrison Ford, who at the time were the biggest movie stars in the world. I was invisible. I, maybe got to listen in on a phone call, but, I got to build relationships with the people that were going to be references for me, agents, managers. And I made a point of just, being the first person in the office every day, last one to leave, made sure that, my work product was stellar. And look, that's always my advice and my takeaway from all of it is like, be great at what you do, whether it's, school, sports, engagement, just be great because people will notice that. And if you make other people look good in the process, they will want to do more with you. So, here I am like late 20s, I'm grinding away and decide again through my observation of the, people I wanted to be when I grew up, I wanted to be one of the people who had a big book of business because that gives you a little bit of independence and leverage. And ultimately, you can go anywhere if you have a portfolio that you can take with you. So I started getting opportunities to meet with people and, it was in the same year, I got a call about meeting this 12-year-old girl who was auditioning to be in a show on the Disney Channel, and her name was Selena Gomez. And she walked into the office with her mom, who wasn't much older than I was, and we had a great conversation. I pitched why I thought I would be helpful in building a, deal for her as she tested for this show called Wizards of Waverly Place, and we got that show. And from there, we've gone on to do really, really extraordinary things in film and TV and music and branding and licensing. So when we talk about the strike and how companies like ours survive during the work stoppage, it's with representing people who do things other than film and TV. And maybe 3 months later, I got a call to meet another young woman at the time who was about to do a small role in a movie that was directed by one of our clients named Judd Apatow, and or was being produced by Judd. And her name was Emma Stone. And then we did a movie called Easy A and Spider-Man. And sort of in the course of about 24 months, as a really young lawyer, I had a couple of very, very well-known, well-respected clients. And as Greg said, sort of the momentum, all of a sudden you're distinguished as someone who's made really interesting deals for people. So some of the clients themselves, ask the people close to them, hey, who did Selena's deal for the Rare Beauty Company? I want to be in business with someone like that. And that's sort of how it rolls off itself. And at this point, we're very fortunate and we're in a position where we get those calls coming in. And really for us now, it's more about making sure we have the time and energy to put the effort into building and shaping careers, as opposed to going out and seeking those people as frequently as we used to.
Thanks. That's really helpful. I'm curious, since you started to talk about the different types of deals that you make, if each of you can sort of talk about, like what types of deals do you tend to do on behalf of clients? What's the sort of breadth of, and I suspect it's different in terms of producers versus directors or writers or actors. So if you can talk a little about that.
Yeah, I think, again, like I said, all we do is transactional work. Like we do the negotiation for Michael B. Jordan's movie, or, Elizabeth Banks is directing a movie. I'll make the deal for her as a director. So, our focus is somewhat narrow, but inside that focus, we're generalists. Like I have as many television creators as I do actors, as I do directors. I think, Greg and I and our other two partners, again, by design, have sort of complementary practices. I would say, I tend to represent a lot of writer performers, people who like to create for themselves, people like Mindy Kaling and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who did Fleabag, and And then I tend to do a lot of the branding stuff and like the celebrity company stuff, like a Rare Beauty or spirits companies for clients.
My practice is largely the same. I do think it is worth noting. I think as your generation especially comes up more and more, I mean, I guess taking a step back for a second, when we were young lawyers, the idea that a celebrity would openly endorse brands was definitely not common. It was actually so uncommon that your typical deal, if you were going to have a major movie star of like the highest order in a brand deal, it was typically done in a different country, somewhere where they could never in the contract ever show the ads in English speaking countries. Like it would be that hidden. They make a lot of money, but they were really, you could restrict things back then. It was not a global social media world, and it wasn't as easy to, it was actually much easier, I should say, to restrict where these things could have been exploited. But this generation, and certainly the generation behind our clients, they all come up seeing the creator economies and understanding that they are brands beyond their talents. And so much of what we do right now is in service of that ambition. So we have so many of our clients that in the last, call it 10 years, I think, recognize that if they're able to have a certain reach, it doesn't have to mean that they're a major movie star, that, you know, they're, you know, in the public eye, you know, globally, they speak to a particular audience and, targeting a specific audience gives you the opportunity to be interesting to brands who no longer need to sell globally. They could sell in a very targeted way. And a lot of our clients are very involved in that kind of brand expansion, and we're at the forefront of that with them. So, especially for our celebrity clients, they're very engaged in finding new ways to create companies, sell products that they now own, as opposed to just doing a deal where they're going to put their face on somebody else's brand.
I'm curious, what do you think led to this shift in attitude and openness to doing that?
Well, I think two things. One is, desire to create other revenue sources, right? When we'll talk about the impact the streaming platforms have had on the economics of film and television, sounds like you've already touched on it. Also, back in about 2000, as Greg said, historically, I don't know, has anybody ever seen the movie Lost in Translation? Right. So Bill Murray plays the, aging prototypical celebrity who goes to Tokyo and does the commercial there. And that's sort of the kind of deals we were working on. Right around 2000, an actress named Catherine Zeta-Jones won the Academy Award for her role in Chicago. And on the heel, just about 6 months before that, she agreed to make a deal with a company called T-Mobile, which was a telecommunications company. And it was a, worldwide endorsement deal that paid her $20 million, which is a lot of money now, and at the time was an extraordinary amount of money. And she subsequently won the Academy Award. And many people, students of this part of the business say that that was sort of the walls coming down, and somebody could both be a movie star and an acclaimed movie star and get paid crazy amounts of money to endorse things. At that time, musicians and sports stars were already getting paid, but it was like the Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise and Julia Roberts, the high profile artists and actors who wouldn't do it. And Catherine's deal sort of opened up the floodgates. And, I think we talk a lot about what the word, the influencer concept and, the consumption of media on different platforms. But from our perspective at this point, all of our celebrity clients are influencers, right? The power to direct consumer behavior on behalf of companies, products, and services. Like, that is at this point, you know, a source of so much wealth for our clients when their day jobs aren't paying as much. So I think part of it is sort of necessity begetting innovation.
That's definitely a test question. Then there was also a shift a few years later, and I think maybe it was Jennifer Aniston's deal for, I think it was Smart Water, but where she got equity. And that was where like the light bulbs went off for a lot of clients who at that time had been paid a lot of cash to endorse brands. But now all of a sudden for brands that maybe weren't as established, you can now own a piece of the company if you, you know, license your name and likeness to those brands as well. So for many years, you had, you know, a real rush for actors and celebrities to want to come on to these, you know, kind of earlier stage companies, get some equity, be the face and name of the associated with those companies for a while. And that went on for a really long time until the next generation came behind and said, you know what, I want to make my own water. And then they become the owner of the actual company from inception. And often it's not literally like they're going to the Alpine and sourcing the water streams, and but they're, you know, figuring out who to partner with. And rather than looking for the opportunities to come on to established companies that are on their way up, they will partner with strategic investors or people who are from those industries and create their own brands. And they own most of the company as opposed to getting a small piece of the equity. And I think that's a big part of, you know, what we're finding ourselves in now, where it's much less common for us with our clients, at least, you know, clients of a certain stature, to, you know, take a small piece of a bigger company. They often want to have most of the company, if not all of it, and you know, and own it and figure out an exit through building that brand. And social media has actually kind of become the great equalizer, because it used to be you had to buy ad space on billboards and on commercials and all these other ways that were so expensive that it was a little cost prohibitive. You really had to have financial backing that was substantial in order to ever get the word out about your product. But now you have a phone, and with one stroke, you're reaching hundreds of millions of people sometimes. And the power of that has really given opportunities that would have been unimaginable 10 years ago. And that's really a big part of you know, kind of how we strategize with our clients to build infrastructure. I'm sorry, to build you know, their businesses and what they view as their empires.
This is really interesting. I'm curious. So you mentioned that you see your clients who are, you know, actors as in part influencers now. Do you take on people who, or have you been taking on people who sort of start as influencers? Or I'm curious if you even see lines in the same way anymore, how, to what extent?
Well, I mean, I think every situation is different. We've probably all represented people who are primarily influencers, at one point. And the truth is, it just depends. I mean, there are plenty of times where it would make sense to represent someone who has a platform where they're engaged in ways that we can be helpful, especially if they're creating content that's, you know, produced and meaningful and has, you know, where they have thoughts of exits that are kind of bigger than just, you know, hitting post, you know, on their social media platforms. And then there are those influencers who are, you know, purely influencers. That's a little less of our strike zone so much. But a lot of influencers have ambitions to, you know, kind of become more established in the traditional film and television space, on streaming or on talk shows or whatever. And that's, I mean, it feels like almost auditions for those kinds of opportunities. And I can't remember the woman's name, but there was someone, she's not a client of ours, who started off as an influencer and wound up getting a late night talk show. And she was amazing. I don't know what happened to the show. I don't think it lasted very long, But there is a natural progression that seems obvious there, because if you're able to have 100 million people watch all of your posts online, and if they're produced and they're, you know, topical, and they're things that, you know, show you're able to really command a camera, there's no reason why you couldn't do something that would translate into a more traditional film and television space. So I think we would consider every opportunity that came around, but it's not really our primary business.
So poll by show of hands, think about all the platforms, the streaming platforms, social media platforms where you consume content media. How many of you spend most of your time consuming content on a streaming platform like Netflix, Amazon, Apple? How about YouTube? How about TikTok? That, you know, that poll, and it's changed dramatically since I started speaking here a few years ago. That to me shows, you know, that like, in order to be competitive, we are, you know, we have to lean into influencers, because clearly like the evolution of consumption is straying away from well-known movie stars and, you know, long form content creators to short form content creators and personalities. So this is definitely an area that we, you know, as we kind of help support our younger lawyers, is an area that we definitely are mindful of.
Thanks. So sort of pivoting back to streaming and more traditional media, as opposed to influencers and social media, I'm curious how you've seen the kinds of deals that you make for talent change over time, the ways they're compensated, because clearly you've alluded to the greater emphasis on brands and businesses. And so what are the ways that people are being paid differently, and how has streaming impacted that?
Okay, so now I'll date myself, because I'll use a bunch of references to shows you've probably never even heard of. So when Greg and I were getting started, you know, the firm we came from before we started our firm was a firm very heavily focused in television creators. Wasn't the sexiest part of the business, but it was by far the most lucrative. So in the old days, you'd be a creator and you'd write a show like Friends, right? You've heard of the show Friends, or Family Guy, or The Simpsons, right? Or Law and Order. You've heard of these shows, right? You probably don't, I don't know, maybe you watch them, but so we would represent these people. And these people would make a deal where they get paid a certain amount to write and produce the shows. But then as the creators, they would own a profit interest in the show. And in the old days, you had a production company that would hire the writer, right? Hire me as the writer. And that company would then own the show. And they would own, call it 65%, and I would own 35%. And maybe some actors and some other people would have a little piece, but let's just make it simple. I own 35%. And they would sell that show to broadcast networks like ABC, NBC, CBS. And they would, you know, license the right for those networks to put the show on the air. So like your parents would watch Law and Order at 8 o'clock at night on a Thursday on NBC, and NBC would pay that production company an amount of money. That production company would also license the right to international networks, and they would all pay. And between the international and the US license fees, you probably already have profits on the show. But then what would happen is that NBC license deal would expire, and the production company could then go sell the rights to cable networks. So again, your parents would watch reruns of Law and Order on USA. And then the production company would also sell what they called, you know, free television rights, syndication rights. So again, your parents, not you, at 11:30 at night were in, you know, up at night and couldn't fall asleep. And they would watch reruns again on Channel 11. And those deals would lapse and then get renewed and renewed. And over the course of the life of a show, that 35% could be worth billions of dollars. You know, you still see reruns of Friends and Law and Order and, you know, The Simpsons and all those Sunday night shows. So in the old days, we would be so focused on how my profits interest was calculated and how these shows were sold from platform to platform. The streamers came in and basically said, and by the way, so did like the major studios. They said, we want you guys to stop looking at our books. We don't want to have to account to you. We don't want to be partners with you anymore. We're going to pay you a shit ton of money up front, and that's going to be all you ever get paid. And so instead of getting paid a fee for writing and producing and then potentially making billions of dollars, they offered $100 million to writer A to sign up in an exclusive deal with Netflix for 4 years. And who's going to say no to $100 million when you haven't done anything, right? You're going to create a show, and without even seeing if it's good or bad, you're going to make $100 million. Or Will Smith is going to go do his next movie. He usually gets paid $20 million and then in great success makes, you know, another 30. Maybe Will Smith isn't the right example, but you get it. Now, all of a sudden, you know, Ryan Gosling is offered $45 million to do a movie. Not going to say no to that. $30 million. Not going to say no to that. And we got into this habit of going away in exchange for what we call a premium. And that premium is sort of more than we would make in the old days. And that has really been the major shift. And, you know, over time, those companies like Netflix and Amazon, who previously were competing for eyeballs and brand identity and therefore willing to spend tons of money to make deals with, you know, key creators and talent, you know, they've now got all their subscribers. They've, you know, slowly kind of ratcheted down price pressures, and the talent in the meantime has sort of let go of that ownership. So that's a big challenge, and one of the reasons we're constantly looking at other arenas to help create, you know, new revenue sources.
What he said. he said it all.
Well, I'm curious. So
could you?
What are the other arenas? So brand management, like, are there other, like, what are the ways that you would see whether writers or directors or actors being able to make money these days?
Well, I think we covered some of that with the brand deals that we discussed. I think, you know, if we're going to talk about where the pressures are right now, I think it's going to be, it's actually has become a lot more challenging. I think the byproduct of what PJ just so eloquently described as this kind of bubble that was created as we went away from the profits model and toward this streaming bonus model, this guarantee where you're just paying cash from tech companies to basically get the most in-demand content. The byproduct is that bubble, I think, is likely to burst if it hasn't burst yet. And a lot of the things that we've enjoyed over the last 10 years, I think it's going to be very hard to maintain those. And I think our job is largely to ensure that that doesn't happen. And it's a big part of what we do and how we spend our time is thinking about how the market is going to try to correct itself and how these companies are going to try to claw back by crying poverty, even though these are tech companies, right? They're not companies that I think view profit and loss the same way that traditional media companies typically have. But I think, you know, really the great kind of struggle of the next few years will likely be, how do we keep prices for our clients at those previous rates? Because I think the strikes, the pandemic, they've really allowed companies to reevaluate those business models. And, you know, a lot of streaming companies, in particular the ones that were chasing Netflix, not the tech companies, not Amazon, not Apple, but Peacock and HBO Max or Max, whatever it's called now, and those kinds of streaming companies have been losing a lot of money to try to catch up to Netflix. And they're not in the business right now of maybe overspending to get the next big actor, writer, or director. on their lot. And so it's going to be really interesting to see how pricing plays out, because we used to call it an arms race, where all of these streaming companies were competing with each other to try to land the next great, you know, creator on their platform. And we'll see if those deals sustain. I think it's safe to say most people are suggesting that they won't sustain. I know that doesn't answer your question. I think, you know, we were, you know, kind of hitting on that point before with regard to, you know, making deals in ancillary markets and finding other ways of creating value through company creation. And that's not limited to actors. I mean, directors are, you know, using AI to create new technologies. And there are brands that we have clients that are, you know, contemplating around all of that. And so you don't just have to be an actor. You could be a director, a writer, and find ways to, you know, kind of create new businesses or new opportunities. But in the ordinary way, it's definitely going to become more challenging in the next few years.
No, thanks. And I was really just trying to see if I had the full spectrum of kind of where people are. I'm curious, as some of these legacy companies in particular seem to be licensing out again, and advertising seems to be entering more into the picture, like, does that involve any sort of reassessment, or do you think a back end or participation type thing is going to reemerge?
Great question. So, like, perfect segue. Like, Greg is way smarter than he looks. He's already thinking about this stuff. Exactly as Professor Perrin just said, you know, our job is to be forward thinking and to try and anticipate, create, and lead the companies to, you know, new paradigms. And, you know, while they're crying poor, immediately there's opportunity in that, right? And the world has gone through a lot. The macroeconomic climate is challenging. Interest rates are super high. It's harder to go out and borrow money. So a lot of these companies are going to be a little bit more risk averse, which means, hey, wait a minute. You know, Greg represents John Watts, this mega director who did Spider-Man, and he represents, you know, Michael B. Jordan and Glenn Powell, and puts them all together, and they've got a really cool movie idea. And you know what? Like, maybe we go to a market and say, hey, you know what? You don't have to pay us 150% of the cost of the movie. We'll take less, but we're going to retain the rights after 7 years. And so, you know, I think what you will see is a great opportunity for, you know, people who have leverage and who have a little bit of risk tolerance to go out and create old or new, you know, deal structures where we can recapture a bunch of rights, have a little more flexibility. And yeah, you're seeing it, right? You've got HBO Max licensing shows to Netflix. I mean, so one of my clients is John Cena this week. You know, I don't know if you read about this, but he had this movie, Coyote versus Acme, really funny, really good movie. And to take a $30 million tax write-off, Warner Brothers decides to scrap the movie and not release it. And they came out and they said, and we're not going to let you take it out. You know, it's just going to go away. We had an exchange of words over the weekend, and you know, it ultimately played very embarrassingly for the studio. Again, the movie tested well. It's actually really good. And we've convinced them to let us take it out. And now Netflix, Amazon, one of these companies is going to come in and buy it or license it. And it ends up being a better opportunity for us. And we'll have the chance to go out and promote it and make fun of Warner Brothers for their blunder. But, you know, like, there's going to be a balancing act between sort of the what we call like schmuck insurance, right? Like, you go out and create Friday, right, at Warner Brothers, and you could put it on Max, but you license it to Netflix. All of a sudden, yeah, you're making money from the license fee, but Netflix has this great show on its platform. So there's going to be a little bit of like managing egos around brands, and as we kind of revert back to these more flexible structures. But that's sort of our job. Our job is to be innovative in our thinking and to find new opportunities so that our clients can maximize the work they're doing.
I'm just trying to imagine all the ways you keep having to update your contracts in completely unanticipated ways. I'm curious, we've talked about ways that the business is likely to contract in the coming years. I'm curious if you see particular growth areas or growth opportunities. I mean, you have alluded to the brand dimension. Are there other ways?
Yeah, I like I said, I think that there are going to be great opportunities for independent studios, independent companies that are willing to take a little risk in exchange for rights and ownership. I mean, again, you see patterns and then the market gets saturated. We've seen some of our clients do incredibly well in the podcasting space. You saw deals like for the Smartless podcast and, you know, and every day someone new is dipping their toe into that market, and it can be a really lucrative business. It is just like the rest of the business. You know, the world is shifting. Platforms like iHeart and, you know, Audible and these companies and Spotify and these companies have definitely slowed the spending, but, you know, that's a new arena. The live event business and the live event to theatrical business, as one musician just demonstrated, is a new and innovative way to create opportunities. So again, I think depending on who you work with, there are a ton of ways to create, you know, new pathways to market directly to your consumer.
I think, and I've been saying this for a long time, so I feel like maybe we're not there yet, and I'm gonna keep saying this every time I come here, but the convergence of gaming and more traditional narrative storytelling, I think, is going to become, you know, generationally incredibly relevant for the younger generation. I don't know if it's yours or the one behind you, but it just feels like the interactivity of games it's just starting to blur the line between traditional narrative entertainment and what was typically just a video game that was, you know, somewhat separate and not interactive, and there was very little relevance to the narrative behind it. And so I think that AI and virtual reality will actually kind of create a whole new area where that's going to become a real growth industry. That's one. And then, like PJ alluded to at the end of what he just said, social media has kind of demonstrated that the direct-to-consumer business is really here right now. That's not like in the future, it's today. And I just don't think it'll be a very long time from now when a creator who is maybe a hyphenate or someone who has friends who are willing to do this as well are going to be able to literally hit post and have their movie, their show, whatever it is, directly streamed to their fan base. And I don't know if it means it's going to be behind a paywall or there'll be some other kind of way for you to get that content, but the middleman is going to be cut out, as Taylor Swift showed us, as it pertains to needing a studio to have her movie in theaters. I think it's going to just, you know, trickle down from there majorly and very, very quickly. So I think that's, to me, the biggest growth area that feels the you know, coming the quickest.
Thanks. So I have one final substantive question, then one small question, and then we'll open up for students. The substantive question is an advice question. We have several students I know in this class who are interested in being entertainment lawyers. So I'm curious, from your perspective, what they might be doing while they're in school or how they can be preparing themselves best if that's a profession they want to pursue.
Definitely encourage you to have as much fun right now as you possibly can, because law school is a lot less, you have a lot less free time then. I think that, you know, we're blessed. We have jobs that I think we both really cherish and we feel very lucky to have. I don't know, you know, how the future generations, I don't know what the business is going to look like in that regard. I think to, you know, think about, you know, where the business is heading, I really do think there's a tremendous amount of growth that's going to create more jobs and more jobs for entertainment lawyers. but they're in ways that I don't think we can even fathom right now, because so much of it is going to, I think, be directly related to new technology. So if it were me, I mean, when we were young lawyers, so much of it was about, you know, corporate law and understanding how companies work and all that kind of stuff. That's still really important. I would spend so much time learning about technology and about the technology that's being launched right now, because, you know, we came up kind of in the dot-com era, which was, you know, a few years after the, you know, internet business really started in earnest. And if you didn't really have that, you know, kind of basic understanding, you would have been in the dark ages, you know, 10 years later. And I think now more than ever, technology is really going to dictate the future of our business. And so I think a lawyer that has that kind of expertise and background, and frankly, with social media as well, I think there's just so much that, you know, if you're thinking about how all those things can converge and really study that from the inside, I think you're going to have a real advantage in our business doing what we do.
You know, I don't know that I have advice specifically about lawyers. I like I said, my advice is be great, be passionate about what you do, be curious. And, you know, if you can find something that inspires you and you can get paid to spend your day doing it, like, how terrific. But also, like Greg said, have fun. Like, there's plenty of time for work, and you'll all do great. I'm already proud of you.
Well, I have to ask my fun question on that note, which is, what are you both watching these days?
I watched, so I'm biased. So one of my clients I mentioned is Emma Stone, and another one of my clients is a guy called Nathan Fielder. Did any of you watch the first episode of The Curse? How sick is that? I mean, I'm twisted, so it's right on for me, but I'm very excited to see where that goes. That is my dirty pleasure right now.
I just finished, a client recommended that I watch a show called Midnight Gospel. Any of you guys seen this? It's crazy. I mean, it's really out there, but I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. It was really interesting. And I watched The Bear. I just finished The Bear. I thought that was awesome. Yeah. Those are the two things I watched most recently.
What am I watching? The Golden Bachelor.
Oh, yeah.
I'll own it. Well, these are all really great questions, but we are out of time. I want to thank you both so much for coming in. This was great.
Thank you for listening to Media Industry Conversations. This has been a co-production of the Department of Radio, Television, Film, and the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries in the Moody College of Communication at the University of Texas at Austin. For more information, please visit rtf.utexas.edu/mic and follow the Center for Entertainment and Media Industries on LinkedIn and Instagram. This series was made possible by the work of Dr. Elisa Perrin and Cindy McCreary, with the assistance of Keith Berner, Christina Brinning, Laura Brown, Paxton Haven, and Maggie McGinnis. This program was co-produced and edited by Sophia Abbey and me, Hannah Wold. We hope you join us next time for another Media Industry Conversation.